Brandy, Galliano, Creme de Menthe, Cointreau, Advocaat, Dark Rum, Light Rum. Slow down, slow down, he said. I wasn't slowing down now. I was, as they say, on a roll. Chapter 15. The boss, a middle-aged man, estimated BMI 27, arrived with the additional supplies just in time for dessert and did some reorganization of the process behind the bar. Dessert was great fun, although it was hard to hear orders over the volume of conversation. I sold primarily the cream-based cocktails, which most of the diners were unfamiliar with, but responded to enthusiastically. As the food waiters cleared the dessert dishes, I made a rough mental calculation of our coverage. It depended a great deal on Rosie, but I believe we had samples from at least 85% of the males. Good, but not optimum use of our opportunity. Having ascertained the names of the guests, I had determined that all but 12 of the Caucasian males from the graduation party were present. The missing 12 included Alan McPhee, unable to attend due to death, but already eliminated by means of his daughter's hairbrush. I headed for the bar, and Dr. Ralph Browning followed me.
Can I bother you for another Cadillac? That was maybe the best drink I've ever had.
The bar staff were packing up, but the boss said to Rosie, make the man a Cadillac. Jenny and Rod Broadhurst appeared from the dining room.
Make that three, said Rod.
The other bar personnel surrounded the owner, and there was a conversation.
These guys have to go, said the boss to me, shrugging his shoulders.
He turned to Rosie. Double time? Meanwhile, the diners were forming a throng around the bar, raising their hands for attention. Rosie handed a Cadillac to Dr. Browning, then turned to the boss.
Sorry, I need at least two to stay. I can't run a bar for 100 people by myself.
Me and him, said the boss, pointing to me.
Finally, I had a chance to use my expertise. Rosie lifted the hinged part of the bar and let me through. Dr. Miranda Ball raised her hand. Same again, please. I called to Rosie loudly as the bar area was now very noisy.
Miranda Ball, Alabama Slammer. One part each slow gin, whiskey, Galliano triple sec, orange juice, orange slice and a cherry.
We're out of triple sec, yelled Rosie.
Substitute Cointreau. Reduce the quantity by 20%.
Dr. Lucas put his finished drink on the bar and raised his finger. One more.
Jerry Lucas, empty glass, I called.
Rosie took the glass. I hope she realized that we didn't have a sample for him yet.
Another anal probe for Dr. Lucas.
Got that,
she called from the kitchen. Excellent, she had remembered to swab. Dr. Martin Van Krieger called out loudly.
Is there a cocktail with Galliano and tequila?
The crowd quietened. This sort of question had become common during dinner, and the guests had seemed impressed with my responses. I took a few moments to think. Martin called out again.
Don't worry if there isn't.
I'm re-indexing my internal database, I said to explain the delay. It took a few moments.
Mexican gold or Freddy Fudpucker?
The crowd applauded.
One of each, he said.
Rosie knew how to make a Freddy Fudpucker. I gave the boss the Mexican gold recipe. We continued in this mode with great success. I decided to take advantage of the opportunity to test all male doctors present, including those I had previously filtered out because of incompatible ethnic appearance. At 1:22 a.m., I was confident that we had tested all but one person. It was time to be proactive.
Dr. Anwar Khan, approach the bar, please.
It was an expression I'd heard used on television. I hoped it carried the required authority. Dr. Khan had only drunk from his water glass and carried it with him to the bar. You haven't ordered a drink all night, I said. Is that a problem? I don't drink alcohol.
Very wise, I said, although I was providing a bad example with a beer open beside me.
I recommend a Virgin Colada, Virgin Mary, Virgin... At this moment, Dr. Eva Gold put her arm around Dr. Khan. She was obviously affected by alcohol.
Loosen up, Anwar.
Dr. Khan looked back at her, then at the crowd, who were, in my assessment, also exhibiting the effects of intoxication.
What the hell, he said. Line up the virgins.
He put his empty glass on the bar. I did not leave the golf club until very late. The last guest departed at 2:32 a.m., 2 hours and 2 minutes after the scheduled completion time. Rosie, the boss, and I had made 143 cocktails.
Rosie and the boss also sold some beer, which I did not keep track of.
You guys can go, said the boss. We'll clean up in the morning.
He extended his hand to me, and I shook it according to custom, although it seemed very late for introductions.
Amgad, he said. Nice work, guys.
He didn't shake Rosie's hand, but looked at her and smiled. I noticed that she was looking a little tired. I was still full of energy.
Got time for a drink, said Amgad.
Excellent idea.
You've got to be kidding, said Rosie. I'm going. All the stuff's in your bag. You don't want to lift, Don.
I had my cycle and had only drunk 3 beers over the course of a long evening. I estimated that my blood alcohol would be well below the legal limit even after a drink with Amgad. Rosie departed.
What's your poison? Said Amgad.
Poison?
What do you want to drink?
Of course, but why can't people just say what they mean? Beer, please. Amgad opened 2 pale ales and we clicked bottles.
How long have you been doing this? He asked.
Though some deception had been necessary for the purposes of the Father Project, I was not comfortable with it.
This is my first work in the field, I said. Did I make some error?
Amgad laughed.
Funny guy, listen, he said. This place here is okay, but it's mostly steak and beer and mid-range wine. Tonight was a one-off, and mainly because of you.
He drank some beer and looked at me without speaking for a while.
I've been thinking of opening in the Inner West. A little cocktail bar with a bit of flair. New York feel, but something a bit extra behind the bar, if you know what I mean. If you're interested, he was offering me a job.
This was flattering, considering my limited experience, and my immediate irrational thought was that I wished Rosie had been present to witness it.
I already have a job, thank you. I'm not talking about a job. I'm talking about a share in a business.
No, thank you, I said. I'm sorry, but I think you would find me unsatisfactory.
Maybe, but I'm a pretty good judge. Give me a call if you change your mind. I'm in no hurry.
The following day was Sunday. Rosie and I arranged to meet at the lab at 3 p.m. She was predictably late and I was already at work. I confirmed that we had obtained samples from all attendees at the reunion, meaning we had now tested all but 11 of the Caucasian males in the class. Rosie arrived in tight blue jeans and a white shirt and headed for the refrigerator. No beer until all samples are tested, I said. The work took some time, and I needed to source additional chemicals from the main laboratory. At 7:06 p.m., Rosie went out for pizza, an unhealthy choice, but I had missed dinner the previous night and calculated that my body would be able to process the extra kilojoules. When she returned, I was testing the 4th-to-last candidate. As we were opening the pizza, my mobile phone rang. I realized immediately who it was.
"You didn't answer at home," said my mother. "I was worried."
This was a reasonable reaction on her part, as her Sunday phone call is part of my weekly schedule.
"Where are you?"
"At work."
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine." It was embarrassing to have Rosie listen to a personal conversation, and I did everything I could to terminate it quickly, keeping my responses as brief as possible. Rosie started laughing, fortunately not loudly enough for my mother to hear, and making funny faces.
"Your mother," she said, when I was finally able to hang up.
"Correct. How did you guess?"
"You sound like any 16-year-old boy talking to his mum in front of..."
She stopped.
My annoyance must have been obvious.
"Or me talking to Phil." It was interesting that Rosie also found conversation with a parent difficult. My mother is a good person, but very focused on sharing personal information. Rosie picked up a slice of pizza and looked at the computer screen.
"I'm guessing no news?"
"Plenty of news. 5 more eliminated, only 4 to go, including this one." The result had come up while I was on the phone. "Delete Anwar Khan." Rosie updated the spreadsheet.
"Allah be praised."
"World's most complicated drink order," I reminded her. Dr. Khan had ordered 5 different drinks, compensating for his abstinence earlier in the evening. At the end of the night, he had left with his arm around Dr. Gold.
"Yeah, and I messed it up too. Put rum in the virgin colada."
"You gave him alcohol?" I presume this was in violation of his personal or religious standards.
"Maybe he'll miss out on his 72 virgins."
I was familiar with this religious theory.
My public position, as negotiated with the Dean, is that I regard all non-science-based beliefs as having equal merit. But I found this one curious. Seems irrational, I said, wanting virgins. Surely a woman with sexual experience would be preferable to a novice. Rosie laughed and opened two beers. Then she stared at me in the way that I'm not supposed to do to others.
Amazing. You. You're the most amazing person I've ever met. I don't know why you're doing this, but thanks.
She tapped her bottle against mine and drank. It was enjoyable to be appreciated. But this was exactly what I'd been worried about when I spoke to Claudia. Now Rosie was asking about my motives. She had applied for the wife project and presumably had expectations on that basis. It was time to be honest. Presumably you think it's in order to initiate a romantic relationship.
The thought had crossed my mind, said Rosie.
Assumption confirmed.
I'm extremely sorry if I've created an incorrect impression.
What do you mean? Said Rosie.
I'm not interested in you as a partner. I should have told you earlier, but you're totally unsuitable.
I tried to gauge Rosie's reaction, but the interpretation of facial expressions is not one of my strengths.
Well, you'll be pleased to know I can cope. I think you're pretty unsuitable too, she said.
This was a relief. I hadn't hurt her feelings, but it did leave a question unanswered.
Then why did you apply for the wife project?
I was using the word apply loosely, as Jean had not required Rosie to complete the questionnaire, but her answer suggested a more serious level of miscommunication.
Wife project? She said, as if she'd never heard of it.
Jean sent you to me as a candidate for the wife project. A wild card.
He did what?
You haven't heard of the wife project? I asked, trying to establish the correct starting point.
No. She said, speaking in the tone that is traditionally used for giving instructions to a child. I have never heard of the wife project, but I'm about to, in detail.
Of course, I said, but we should timeshare it with pizza consumption and beer drinking.
Of course, said Rosie.
I explained in some detail about the wife project, including the review with Jean and field visits to dating establishments. I finished as we consumed the final slices of pizza. Rosie had not really asked any questions, except to make exclamations such as Jesus and fuck.
So, said Rosie, are you still doing it, the wife project?
I explained that the project was still technically active, but in the absence of any qualified candidates, there'd been no progress.
What a shame, said Rosie. The perfect woman hasn't checked in yet.
I would assume that there is more than one candidate who meets the criteria, I said, but it's like finding a bone marrow donor. Not enough registrations.
I can only hope that enough women realize their civic duty and take the test.
It was an interesting comment. I didn't really feel it was a duty. In the last few weeks, reflecting on the wife project and its lack of success, I'd felt sad that there were so many women who were looking for partners and desperate enough to register, even though there was only a low probability that they would meet the criteria. It's entirely optional, I said.
How nice for them. Here's a thought for you. Any woman who takes that test is happy to be treated as an object. You can say that's their choice. But if you spent 2 minutes looking at how much society forces women to think of themselves as objects, you might not think so. What I want to know is, do you want a woman who thinks like that? Is that the sort of wife you want?
Rosie was sounding angry. You know why I dress the way I do? Why these glasses? Because I don't want to be treated as an object. If you knew how insulted I am that you think I was an applicant, a candidate, then why did you come to see me that day? I asked. The day of the jacket incident.
She shook her head. Remember at your apartment, on your balcony, I asked you a question about the size of testicles.
I nodded. It didn't strike you as odd that here I was, on a first date, asking about testicles?
Not really. On a date, I'm too focused on not saying odd things myself.
Okay, strike that.
She seemed a little calmer. The reason I asked the question was that I had a bet with Jean. Jean, who is a sexist pig, bet me that humans were naturally non-monogamous and that the evidence was the size of their testicles. He sent me to a genetics expert to settle the bet.
It took me a few moments to process fully the implications of what Rosie was saying. Jean had not prepared her for the dinner invitation. A woman, Rosie, had accepted an offer of a date with me without being pre-warned, set up. I was suffused with an irrationally disproportionate sense of satisfaction. But Jean had misled me, and it seemed he had taken advantage of Rosie financially. "Did you lose much money?" I asked. "It seems exploitative for a professor of psychology to make a bet with a barmaid. I'm not a fucking barmaid!" I could tell by the use of the obscenity that Rosie was getting angry again, but she could hardly contradict the evidence. I realized my error, one that would have caused trouble if I'd made it in front of a class. "Bar person." "Bartender is the established non-sexist term," she said. "That's not the point. It's my part-time job. I'm doing my PhD in psychology, okay? In Jean's department. Does that make sense now?" Of course. I suddenly remembered where I'd seen her before, arguing with Jean after his public lecture. I recalled that Jean had asked her to have coffee with him, as he habitually did with attractive women, but that she had refused. For some reason, I felt pleased about this. But if I had recognized her when she first came to my office, the whole misunderstanding could have been avoided. Everything now made sense, including the performance she'd given in her medical school inquiry, except for two things. "Why didn't you tell me?" "Because I am a barmaid, and I'm not ashamed of it. You can take me or leave me as a barmaid." I assumed she was speaking metaphorically. "Excellent," I said. "That explains almost everything." "Oh, that's fine, then. Why the almost? Don't feel you have to leave anything hanging." "Why Jean didn't tell me?" "Because he's an asshole. Jean is my best friend." "God help you," she said. With matters clarified, it was time to finish the project, although our chances of finding the father tonight were looking poor. 14 candidates remained, and we had only 3 samples left. I got up and walked to the machine. "Listen," said Rosie, "I'm going to ask you again. Why are you doing this?" I remembered my reflection on this question, and the answer I had reached involving scientific challenge and altruism to adjacent humans. But as I began my explanation, I realized that it was not true. Tonight we had corrected numerous invalid assumptions and errors in communication. I should not create a new one. "I don't know," I said. I turned back to the machine and began to load the sample. My work was interrupted by a sudden smashing of glass. Rosie had thrown a beaker, fortunately not one containing an untested sample, against the wall. "I am so, so over this!" She walked out. The next morning there was a knock at my office door. "Rosie." "Enter," I said. "I assume you want to know the final 3 results." Rosie walked unnaturally slowly to my desk where I was reviewing some potentially life-changing data. "No," she said. "I figured they were negative. Even you would have phoned if you'd got a match." "Correct." She stood and looked at me without saying anything. I'm aware that such silences are provided as opportunities for me to speak further, but I could think of nothing useful to say. Finally, she filled the gap. "Hey, sorry I blew up last night." "Totally understandable. It's incredibly frustrating to work so hard for no result, but very common in science." I remembered that she was a science graduate as well as a barmaid. "As you know." "I meant your wife project. I think it's wrong. But you're no different from every other man I know in objectifying women. Just more honest about it. Anyway, you've done so much for me." "A communication error. Fortunately, now rectified. We can proceed with the father project without the personal aspect." "Not till I understand why you're doing it." That difficult question again. But she'd been happy to proceed when she thought that my motivation was romantic interest, even though she did not reciprocate that interest. "There has been no change in my motivation," I said, truthfully. "It was your motivation that was a concern. I thought you were interested in me as a partner. Fortunately, that assumption was based on false information." "Shouldn't you be spending the time on your objectification project?" The question was perfectly timed. The data I was looking at on my screen indicated a major breakthrough. "Good news. I have an applicant who satisfies all requirements." "Well," said Rosie, "you won't be needing me." This was a truly strange response. I hadn't needed Rosie for anything other than her own project.
Chapter 16. The candidate's name was Bianca Rivera, and she met all criteria. There was one obstacle, which I would need to devote time to. She noted that she had twice won the state ballroom dancing championship and required her partner to be an accomplished dancer. It seemed perfectly reasonable for her to have some criteria of her own, and this one was easy to satisfy, and I had the perfect place to take her. I called Regina, the dean's assistant, and confirmed that she was still selling tickets for the faculty ball. Then I emailed Bianca and invited her as my partner. She accepted. I had a date. The perfect date. Now I had 10 days to learn to dance. Jean entered my office as I was practicing my dance steps.
I think the longevity statistics were based on marriages to live women, Don.
He was referring to the skeleton I was using for practice. I had obtained it on loan from the anatomy department, and no one had asked what I required it for. Judging from the pelvis size, it was almost certainly a male skeleton, but this was irrelevant for dancing practice. I explained its purpose to Jean, pointing out the scene from the film Grease that was showing on the wall of my office.
So, said Jean, Miss Wright, sorry, Dr. Wright, PhD, just popped into your inbox.
Her name's not Wright, I said, it's Rivera.
Photo?
Not necessary. The meeting arrangements are quite precise. She's coming to the faculty ball.
Oh, shit.
Jean went silent for a while and I resumed dancing practice.
Don, the faculty ball is Friday after next.
Correct.
You can't learn to dance in 9 days.
10. I started yesterday. The steps are trivial to remember. I just need to practice the mechanics. They're considerably less demanding than martial arts. I demonstrated a sequence.
Very impressive, said Jean.
Sit down, Don.
I sat. I hope you're not too pissed off at me about Rosie, he said. I'd almost forgotten. Why didn't you tell me she was a psychology student and about the bet?
From what Claudia said, you guys seemed to be having a good time. I thought if she wasn't telling you, it was for a reason. She may be a bit twisted, but she's not stupid.
Perfectly reasonable, I said. On matters of human interaction, why argue with a professor of psychology?
I'm glad one of you's all right with it, said Jean.
I have to tell you, Rosie was a little unhappy with me. A little unhappy with life.
Listen, Don, I persuaded her to go to the ball, alone. If you knew how often Rosie takes my advice, you'd realize what a big deal that was. I was going to suggest you do the same.
Take your advice?
No, go to the ball. Alone, or invite Rosie as your partner.
I now saw what Jean was suggesting. Jean is so focused on attraction and sex that he sees it everywhere. This time he was totally in error. Rosie and I discussed the question of a relationship explicitly. Neither of us is interested.
Since when do women discuss anything explicitly? Said Jean.
I visited Claudia for some advice on my crucial date with Bianca. I assumed that she would be there in her role as Jean's wife, and I advised her that I might require assistance on the night. It turned out she wasn't even aware of the ball.
Just be yourself, Don. If she doesn't want you for yourself, then she's not the right person for you.
I think it's unlikely that any woman would accept me for myself.
What about Daphne? Asked Claudia.
It was true. Daphne was unlike the women I had dated. This was excellent therapy. Refutation by counter-example. Perhaps Bianca would be a younger, dancing version of Daphne.
And what about Rosie? Asked Claudia.
Rosie is totally unsuitable.
I wasn't asking that, said Claudia. Just whether she accepts you for yourself.
I thought about it for a few moments. It was a difficult question.
I think so, because she isn't evaluating me as a partner.
It's probably good that you feel like that, said Claudia.
Feel. Feel, feel, feel.
Feelings were disrupting my sense of well-being. In addition to a nagging desire to be working on the father project rather than the wife project, I now had a high level of anxiety related to Bianca. Throughout my life, I have been criticized for a perceived lack of emotion.
as if this were some absolute fault. Interactions with psychiatrists and psychologists, even including Claudia, start from the premise that I should be more in touch with my emotions. What they really mean is that I should give in to them. I am perfectly happy to detect, recognize, and analyze emotions. This is a useful skill, and I would like to be better at it. Occasionally, an emotion can be enjoyed. The gratitude I felt for my sister, who visited me even during the bad times. The primitive feeling of well-being after a glass of wine. But we need to be vigilant that emotions do not cripple us. I diagnosed brain overload and set up a spreadsheet to analyze the situation. I began by listing the recent disturbances to my schedule. Two were unquestionably positive. Eva, the short-skirted cleaner, was doing an excellent job and had freed up considerable time. Without her, most of the recent additional activities would not have been possible, and, anxiety notwithstanding, I had my first fully qualified applicant for the wife project. I had made a decision that I wanted a partner, and for the first time I had a viable candidate. Logic dictated that the wife project, to which I had planned to allocate most of my free time, should now receive maximum attention. Here, I identified problem number one. My emotions were not aligned with logic. I was reluctant to pursue the opportunity. I did not know whether to list the father project as positive or negative, but it had consumed enormous time for zero outcome. My arguments for pursuing it had always been weak, and I had done far more than could reasonably be expected of me. If Rosie wanted to locate and obtain DNA from the remaining candidates, she could do so herself. She now had substantial practical experience with the collection procedure. I could offer to perform the actual tests. Once again, logic and emotion were not in step. I wanted to continue the father project. Why? It is virtually impossible to make useful comparisons of levels of happiness, especially across long periods of time. But if I'd been asked to choose the happiest day of my life, I would have nominated, without hesitation, the first day I spent at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, when I travelled there for a conference during my PhD studies. The second best day was the second day there, and the third best, the third day there. But after recent events, it was not so clear. It was difficult to choose between the Natural History Museum and the night of cocktail making at the golf club. Should I therefore consider resigning my job and accepting Amgad's offer of a partnership in a cocktail bar? Would I be permanently happier? The idea seemed ludicrous. The cause of my confusion was that I was dealing with an equation which contained large negative values, most seriously the disruption to my schedule, and large positive values, the consequential enjoyable experiences. My inability to quantify these factors accurately meant that I could not determine the net result, negative or positive, and the margin of error was huge. I marked the father project as being of undetermined net value and ranked it the most serious disturbance. The last item on my spreadsheet was the immediate risk that my nervousness and ambivalence about the wife project would impede my social interaction with Bianca. I was not concerned about the dancing. I was confident that I could draw on my experience of preparing for martial arts competitions, with the supplementary advantage of an optimum intake of alcohol, which for martial arts is not permitted. My concern was more with social faux pas. It would be terrible to lose the perfect relationship because I failed to detect sarcasm, or looked into her eyes for greater or less than the conventional period of time. I reassured myself that Claudia was essentially correct. If these things concerned Bianca excessively, she was not the perfect match, and I would at least be in a position to refine the questionnaire for future use. I visited a formal costume hire establishment as recommended by Jean and specified maximum formality. I did not want a repeat of the jacket incident. Chapter 17. The ball was on a Friday evening at a reception centre on the river. For efficiency, I had brought my costume to work and practiced the cha-cha and rumba with my skeleton while I waited to leave. When I went to the lab to get a beer, I felt a strong twinge of emotion. I was missing the stimulation of the father project. The morning suit, with its tails and tall hat, was totally impractical for cycling,
so I took a taxi and arrived at exactly 7:55 p.m. as planned. Behind me, another taxi pulled up and a tall, dark-haired woman stepped out. She was wearing the world's most amazing dress. Multiple bright colours, red, blue, yellow, green, with a complex structure including a split up one side. I'd never seen anyone so spectacular. Estimated age 35, BMI 22, consistent with the questionnaire responses. Neither a little early nor a little late. Was I looking at my future wife? It was almost unbelievable. As I stepped out of the taxi, she looked at me for a moment, then turned and walked towards the door. I took a deep breath and followed. She stepped inside and looked around. She saw me again and looked more carefully this time. I approached her, close enough to speak, being careful not to invade her personal space. I looked into her eyes. I counted. 1, 2. Then I lowered my eyes a little, downwards, but only a tiny distance. "Hi," I said. "I'm Don." She looked at me for a while, before extending her hand to shake with low pressure. "I'm Bianca. You've really dressed up." Of course, the invitation specified formal. After approximately 2 seconds, she burst into laughter. "You had me for a minute there, so deadpan. You know, you write good sense of humour on the list of things you're looking for, but you never expect to get a real comedian. I think you and I are going to have fun." Things were going extremely well. The ballroom was huge. Dozens of tables with formally dressed academics. Everyone turned to look at us, and it was obvious that we had made an impression. At first I thought it must be Bianca's spectacular dress, but there were numerous other interestingly dressed women. Then I noticed that the men were almost without exception dressed in black suits with white shirts and bow ties. None wore tails or a hat. It accounted for Bianca's initial reaction. It was annoying, but not a situation I was unfamiliar with. I doffed my hat to the crowd, and they shouted greetings. Bianca seemed to enjoy the attention. We were at table 12, according to the seating index, right on the edge of the dance floor. A band was tuning up. Observing their instruments, it seemed that my skills at cha-cha, samba, rumba, foxtrot, waltz, tango, and lambada would not be required. I would need to draw on the work of the second day of the dancing project, rock and roll. Jean's recommendation to arrive 30 minutes after the official start time meant that all but three of the seats at the table were already occupied. One of these belonged to Jean, who was walking around pouring champagne. Claudia was not present. I identified Laszlo Hevesi from physics, who was dressed totally inappropriately in combat trousers and a hiking shirt, sitting next to a woman whom I recognized with surprise as Frances from the speed dating night. On Laszlo's other side was the beautiful Helena. There was also a dark-haired man of about 30, BMI approximately 20, who appeared not to have shaved for several days, and beside him, the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. In contrast to the complexity of Bianca's costume, she was wearing a green dress with zero decoration, so minimal that it did not even have straps to hold it in place. It took me a moment to realize that its wearer was Rosie. Bianca and I took the two vacant seats between Stubbleman and Francis, following the alternating male-female pattern that had been established. Rosie began the introductions, and I recognized the protocol that I had learned for conferences and never actually used. "Don, this is Stefan." She was referring to Stubbleman. I extended my hand and shook, matching his pressure, which I judged as excessive. I had an immediate negative reaction to him. I'm generally not competent at assessing other humans, except through the content of their conversational written communication, but I am reasonably astute at identifying students who are likely to be disruptive. "Your reputation precedes you," Stefan said. Perhaps my assessment was too hasty. "You're familiar with my work." "You might say that," he laughed. I realized that I could not pursue the conversation until I introduced Bianca. "Rosie, Stefan, allow me to present Bianca Rivera." Rosie extended her hand and said, "Delighted to meet you." They smiled hard at each other, and Stefan shook Bianca's hand also. My duty done, I turned to Laszlo, whom I had not spoken to for some time.
Laszlo is the only person I know with poorer social skills than mine, and it was reassuring to have him nearby for contrast. "Greetings, Laszlo," I said, assessing that formality would not be appropriate in his case. "Greetings, Francis. You found a partner. How many encounters were required?"
"Jin introduced us," said Laszlo. He was staring inappropriately at Rosie. Jean gave a thumbs-up signal to Laszlo, then moved between Bianca and me with the champagne bottle. Bianca immediately upended her glass.
"Don and I don't drink," she said, turning mine down as well. Jean gave me a huge smile. It was an odd response to an annoying version control oversight on my part. Bianca had apparently responded to the original questionnaire. Rosie asked Bianca, "How do you and Don know each other?"
"We share an interest in dancing," Bianca said. I thought this was an excellent reply, not referring to the wife project, but Rosie gave me a strange look.
"How nice," she said. "I'm a bit too busy with my PhD to have time for dancing."
"You have to be organized," said Bianca. "I believe in being very organized."
"Yes," said Rosie.
The first time I made the final of the Nationals was in the middle of my PhD. I thought about dropping the triathlon or the Japanese cookery course, but..."
Rosie smiled, but not in the way she usually did.
"No, that would have been silly. Men love a woman who can cook." "I like to think we've moved beyond that sort of stereotyping," said Bianca. "Don's quite a cook himself." Claudia's suggestion that I mention my competence in cooking on the questionnaire had obviously been effective. Rosie provided some evidence.
"He's fabulous. We had the most amazing lobster on his balcony."
"Oh, really?" It was helpful that Rosie was recommending me to Bianca, but Stefan was displaying the disruptive student expression again. I applied my lecture technique of asking him a question first. "Are you Rosie's boyfriend?" Stefan did not have a ready answer, and in a lecture that would have been my cue to continue, with the student now healthily wary of me. But Rosie answered for him. "Stefan is doing his PhD with me."
"I believe the term is partner," said Stefan.
"For this evening," said Rosie. Stefan smiled. "First date." It was odd that they did not seem to have agreed on the nature of their relationship. Rosie turned back to Bianca.
"And yours and Don's first date too."
"That's right, Rosie. How did you find the questionnaire?" Bianca looked quickly at me, then turned back to Rosie.
"Wonderful. Most men only want to talk about themselves. It was so nice to have someone focusing on me."
"I can see how that would work for you," said Rosie.
"And a dancer," Bianca said. "I couldn't believe my luck. But you know what they say, the harder I work, the luckier I get."
Rosie picked up her champagne glass and Stefan said, "How long have you been dancing, Don?
Won any prizes?" I was saved from answering by the arrival of the dean. She was wearing a complex pink dress, the lower part of which spread out widely and was accompanied by a woman of approximately the same age dressed in the standard male ball costume of black suit and bow tie. The reaction of the ball-goers was similar to that at my entrance, without the friendly greetings at the end.
"Oh, dear," said Bianca.
I had a low opinion of the dean, but the comment made me uncomfortable.
"You have a problem with gay women," said Rosie, slightly aggressively.
"Not at all," said Bianca. "My problem's with her dress sense."
"You'll have fun with Don, then," said Rosie.
"I think Don looks fabulous," said Bianca. "Takes flair to pull off something a little different. Anyone can wear a dinner suit or a plain frock. Don't you think so, Don?" I nodded in polite agreement. Bianca was exhibiting exactly the characteristics I was looking for. There was every chance she would be perfect. But for some reason, my instincts were rebelling. Perhaps it was the no drinking rule. My underlying addiction to alcohol was causing my subconscious to send a signal to reject someone who stopped me drinking. I needed to overcome it. We finished our entrees and the band played a few loud chords. Stefan walked over to them and took the microphone from the singer.
"Good evening, everyone," he said. "I thought you should know that we have a former finalist in the National Dancing Championships with us this evening. You may have seen her on television, Bianca Rivera. Let's give Bianca and her partner, Don, a few minutes to entertain us."
I had not expected my first performance to be so public.
but there was the advantage of an unobstructed dance floor. I have given lectures to larger audiences and participated in martial arts bouts in front of crowds. There was no reason to be nervous. Bianca and I stepped onto the dance floor. I took her in the standard jive hold that I had practiced on the skeleton, and immediately felt the awkwardness, approaching revulsion, that I feel when forced into intimate contact with another human. I had mentally prepared for this, but not for a more serious problem. I had not practiced with music. I'm sure I executed the steps accurately, but not at precisely the correct speed, and not at the same time as the beat. We were immediately tripping over each other, and the net effect was a disaster. Bianca tried to lead, but I had no experience with a living partner, let alone one who was trying to be in control. People began laughing. I'm an expert at being laughed at, and as Bianca pulled away from me, I scanned the audience to see who was not laughing, an excellent means of identifying friends. Jean and Rosie, and surprisingly the Dean and her partner, were my friends tonight. Stefan was definitely not. Something major was required to save the situation. In my dancing research, I had noticed some specialized moves that I had not intended to use but remembered because they were so interesting. They had the advantage of not being highly dependent on synchronized timing or body contact. Now was the time to deploy them. I performed the running man, milking the cow, and the fishing imitation, reeling Bianca in, though she did not actually move as required. In fact, she was standing totally still. Finally, I attempted a body contact maneuver, traditionally used for a spectacular finish, in which the male swings the female on either side, over his back, and between his legs. Unfortunately, this requires cooperation on the part of the partner, particularly if she is heavier than a skeleton. Bianca offered no such cooperation, and the effect was as if I had attacked her. Unlike Aikido, dancing training apparently does not include practice in falling safely. I offered to help her up, but she ignored my hand and walked towards the bathroom, apparently uninjured. I went back to the table and sat down. Stefan was still laughing. "You bastard," Rosie said to him. Jean said something to Rosie, presumably to prevent inappropriate public anger, and she seemed to calm down. Bianca returned to her seat, but only to collect her bag. "The problem is synchronization," I tried to tell her. The metronome in my head is not set to the same frequency as the band." Bianca turned away, but Rosie seemed prepared to listen to my explanation. I turned off the sound during practice so I could focus on learning the steps. Rosie did not reply, and I heard Bianca speaking to Stefan. "It happens. This isn't the first time, just the worst. Men say they can dance." She walked towards the exit without saying goodnight to me, but Jean followed and intercepted her. This gave me an opportunity. I righted my glass and filled it with wine. It was a poorly made Gordo Blanco with excessive residual sugar. I drank it and poured another. Rosie got up from her seat and walked over to the band. She spoke to the singer, then the drummer. She returned and pointed at me in a stylized manner. I recognized the action. I'd seen it 12 times. It was the signal that Olivia Newton-John gave to John Travolta in Greece to commence the dance sequence that I'd been practicing when Jean interrupted me 9 days earlier. Rosie pulled me towards the dance floor.
"Dance," she said. "Just fucking dance."
I started dancing without music. This was what I had practiced. Rosie followed according to my tempo. Then she raised her arm and started waving it in time with our movements. I heard the drummer start playing and could tell in my body that he was in time with us. I barely noticed the rest of the band start up. Rosie was a good dancer and considerably easier to manipulate than the skeleton. I led her through the more difficult moves, totally focused on the mechanics and on not making errors. The Grease song finished and everyone clapped. But before we could return to the table, the band started again and the audience clapped in time. Satisfaction. It may have been due to the effect of the Gordo Blanco on my cognitive functions, but I was suddenly overwhelmed by an extraordinary feeling, not of satisfaction, but of absolute joy. It was the feeling I had in the Museum of Natural History and when I was making cocktails. We started dancing again, and this time I allowed myself to focus on the sensations of my body moving to the beat of the song from my childhood, and of Rosie moving to the same rhythm.
The music finished, and everyone clapped again. I looked for Bianca, my date, and located her near the exit with Jean. I had presumed she would be impressed that the problem was solved, but even from a distance and with my limited ability to interpret expressions, I could see that she was furious. She turned and left. The rest of the evening was incredible, changed totally by one dance. Everyone came up to Rosie and me to offer compliments. The photographer gave us each a photo without charging us. Stefan left early. Jean obtained some high-quality champagne from the bar, and we drank several glasses with him and a Hungarian postdoc named Clara from physics. Rosie and I danced again, and then I danced with almost every woman at the ball. I asked Jean if I should invite the dean or her partner, but he considered this to be a question beyond even his social expertise. In the end, I did not, as the dean was visibly in a bad mood. The crowd had made it clear that they would rather dance than listen to her scheduled speech. At the end of the night, the band played a waltz, and when it was finished, I looked around and it was just Rosie and me on the dance floor, and everyone applauded again. It was only later that I realized that I had experienced extended close contact with another human without feeling uncomfortable. I attributed it to my concentration on correctly executing the dance steps. "You want to share a taxi?" asked Rosie. It seemed a sensible use of fossil fuel. In the taxi, Rosie said to me, "You should have practiced with different beats. You're not as smart as I thought you were." I just looked out the window of the taxi. Then she said, "No way. No fucking way. You did, didn't you? That's worse. You'd rather make a fool of yourself in front of everyone than tell her she didn't float your boat." It would have been extremely awkward. I had no reason to reject her. Besides not wanting to marry a parakeet, said Rosie. I found this incredibly funny, no doubt as a result of alcohol and decompensation after the stress. We both laughed for several minutes, and Rosie even touched me a few times on the shoulder. I didn't mind, but when we stopped laughing, I felt awkward again and averted my gaze. "You're unbelievable," said Rosie. "Look at me when I'm talking." I kept looking out the window. I was already overstimulated. "I know what you look like." "What color eyes do I have?" "Brown." "When I was born, I had blue eyes," she said. "Baby blues, like my mother. She was Irish, but she had blue eyes. Then they turned brown." I looked at Rosie. This was incredible. "Your mother's eyes change color." "My eyes. It happens with babies. That was when my mother realized that Phil wasn't my father. She had blue eyes, and so does Phil. And she decided to tell him. I suppose I should be grateful he wasn't a lion." I was having trouble making sense of all that Rosie was saying, doubtless due to the effects of the alcohol and her perfume. However, she had given me an opportunity to keep the conversation on safe ground. The inheritance of common genetically influenced traits such as eye color is more complex than is generally understood, and I was confident that I could speak on the topic for long enough to occupy the remainder of our journey. But I realized that this was a defensive action and impolite to Rosie, who had risked considerable embarrassment and damage to her relationship with Stefan for my benefit. I rolled back my thoughts and repassed her statement. "I suppose I should be grateful he wasn't a lion." I assumed she was referring to our conversation on the night of the balcony meal, when I informed her that lions kill the offspring of previous matings. Perhaps she wanted to talk about Phil. This was interesting to me, too. The entire motivation for the father project was Phil's failure in that role. But Rosie had offered no real evidence beyond his opposition to alcohol, ownership of an impractical vehicle, and selection of a jewelry box as a gift. "Was he violent?" I asked. "No." She paused for a while. "He was just all over the place. One day I'd be the most special kid in the world. Next day he didn't want me there." This seemed very general, and hardly a justification for a major DNA investigation project. "Can you provide an example?" "Where do I start?" "Okay. The first time is when I was 10. He promised to take me to Disneyland. I told everyone at school, and I waited and waited and waited, and it never happened." The taxi stopped outside a block of flats. Rosie kept talking, looking at the back of the driver's seat.
So, I have this whole thing about rejection. She turned to me. How do you deal with it? The problem has never occurred, I told her. It was not the time to begin a new conversation. Bullshit, said Rosie. It appeared that I would need to answer honestly. I was in the presence of a psychology graduate. There were some problems at school, I said. Hence the martial arts. But I developed some non-violent techniques for dealing with difficult social situations. Like tonight. I emphasize the things that people found amusing. Rosie didn't respond. I recognized the therapy technique, but could not think of anything to do but elaborate. I didn't have many friends. Basically zero, except my sister. Unfortunately, she died 2 years ago due to medical incompetence. What happened? Said Rosie quietly. An undiagnosed ectopic pregnancy. Oh, Dawn, said Rosie very sympathetically. I sensed that I'd chosen an appropriate person to confide in. Was she in a relationship? No. I anticipated her next question. We never found out the source. What was her name? This was, on the surface, an innocuous question, though I could see no purpose in Rosie knowing my sister's name. The indirect reference was unambiguous, as I had only one sister. But I felt very uncomfortable. It took me a few moments to realize why. Although there had been no deliberate decision on my part, I had not said her name since her death. Michelle, I said to Rosie. After that, neither of us spoke for a while. The taxi driver coughed artificially. I presumed he wasn't asking for a beer. You want to come up? Said Rosie. I was feeling overwhelmed. Meeting Bianca, dancing, rejection by Bianca, social overload, discussion of personal matters. Now, just when I thought the ordeal was over, Rosie seemed to be proposing more conversation. I was not sure I could cope. It's extremely late, I said. I was sure this was a socially acceptable way of saying that I wanted to go home. The taxi fares go down again in the morning. If I understood correctly, I was now definitely far out of my depth. I needed to be sure that I wasn't misinterpreting her. Are you suggesting I stay the night? Maybe. First you have to listen to the story of my life. Warning! Danger, Will Robinson, unidentified alien approaching. I could feel myself slipping into the emotional abyss. I managed to stay calm enough to respond. Unfortunately, I have a number of activities scheduled for the morning. Routine. Normality. Rosie opened the taxi door. I willed her to go. But she had more to say. Don, can I ask you something? One question. Do you find me attractive? Jean told me the next day that I got it wrong. But he was not in a taxi after an evening of total sensory overload with the most beautiful woman in the world. I believed I did well. I detected the trick question. I wanted Rosie to like me, and I remembered her passionate statement about men treating women as objects. She was testing to see if I saw her as an object or as a person. Obviously, the correct answer was the latter. I haven't really noticed, I told the most beautiful woman in the world. Chapter 18. I texted Jean from the taxi. It was 1:08 a.m., but he had left the ball at the same time as I did and had further to travel. Urgent. Run tomorrow, 6 a.m. Jean texted back. Sunday at 8. Bring Bianca's contact info. I was about to insist on the earlier date when I realized that I could profitably use the time to organize my thoughts. It seemed obvious that Rosie had invited me to have sex with her. I was right to have avoided the situation. We had both drunk a substantial quantity of champagne, and alcohol is notorious for encouraging unwise decisions about sex. Rosie had the perfect example. Her mother's decision, doubtless prompted by alcohol, was still causing Rosie significant distress.
My own sexual experience was limited. Jean had advised that it was conventional to wait until the third date, and my relationships had never progressed beyond the first. In fact, Rosie and I had technically had only one date, the night of the jacket incident and the balcony meal. I did not use the services of brothels, not for any moral reason, but because I found the idea distasteful. This was not a rational reason, but since the benefits I was seeking were only primitive, a primitive reason was sufficient. But I now seemed to have an opportunity for what Jean would call no-strings-attached sex. The required conditions were in place. Rosie and I had clearly agreed that neither of us had an interest in a romantic relationship. Then Rosie had indicated that she wanted to have sex with me. Did I want to have sex with Rosie? There seemed no logical reason not to, leaving me free to obey the dictates of my primitive desires. The answer was an extremely clear yes. Having made this completely rational decision, I could think of nothing else. On Sunday morning, Jean met me outside his house. I had brought Bianca's contact details and checked her nationality, Panamanian. Jean was very pleased about the latter. Jean wanted full details of my encounter with Rosie, but I had decided it was a waste of effort to explain it twice. I would tell him and Claudia together. As I had no other subject to discuss, and Jean had difficulty in running and speaking concurrently, we spent the next 47 minutes in silence. When we returned to Jean's house, Claudia and Eugenie were having breakfast. I sat down and said, "I require some advice."
"Can it wait?" said Claudia. "We have to take Eugenie to horse riding, and then we're meeting people for brunch."
"No, I may have made a social error. I broke one of Jean's rules." Jean said, "Don, I think the Panamanian bird has flown. Put that one down to experience." The rule applies to Rosie, not Bianca. Never pass up a chance to have sex with a woman under 30.
"Jean told you that," said Claudia.
Carl had entered the room, and I prepared to defend myself against his ritual attack, but he stopped to look at his father. "I thought I should consult with you because you're a psychologist, and with Jean because of his extensive practical experience," I said. Jean looked at Claudia, then at Carl. "In my misspent youth," he said, "not my teens," he turned back to me, "I think this can wait till lunch tomorrow."
"What about Claudia?" I asked.
Claudia got up from the table.
"I'm sure there's nothing Jean doesn't know."
This was encouraging, especially coming from his wife.
"You said what?" said Jean. "We were having lunch in the university club as scheduled."
I said that I hadn't noticed her appearance. I didn't want her to think I saw her as a sexual object.
"Jesus," said Jean. "The one time you think before you speak is the one time you shouldn't have."
"I should have said she was beautiful?" I was incredulous.
"Got it in one," said Jean, incorrectly, as the problem was that I hadn't got it right the first time. "That'll explain the cake."
I must have looked blank, for obvious reasons.
"She's been eating chocolate cake at her desk for breakfast."
This seemed to me to be an unhealthy choice, consistent with smoking, but not an indicator of distress. But Jean assured me that it was to make herself feel better. Having supplied Jean with the necessary background information, I presented my problem.
"You're saying she's not the one," said Jean, "not a life partner."
"Totally unsuitable. But she's extremely attractive. If I'm going to have uncommitted sex with anyone, she's the perfect candidate. She has no emotional attachment to me either."
"So why the stress?" said Jean. "You have had sex before."
"Of course," I said. "My doctor is strongly in favour."
"Frontiers of medical science," said Jean.
He was probably making a joke. I think the value of regular sex has been known for some time. I explained further. "It's just that adding a second person makes it more complicated."
"Naturally," said Jean. "I should have thought of that.
Why not get a book?"
The information was available on the internet, but a few minutes of examining the search results on sexual positions convinced me that the book option would provide a more relevant tutorial with less extraneous information. I had no difficulty in finding a suitable book, and back in my office, selected a random position. It was called the Reverse Cowboy Position, Variant 2. I tried it. Simple. But, as I had pointed out to Jean, The problem was the involvement of the second person. I got the skeleton from the closet and arranged it on top of me, following the diagram in the book. There is a rule at the university that no one opens a door without knocking first. Jean violates it in my case, but we are good friends. I do not consider the